Way to package brains for sure. That should do it. Thanks, I said, then let out a sigh. Damn it, this sure went to hell. Yes, ma'am, he said as he took the empty. I could see that. In a smooth move, he pulled a business card from an inner pocket of his suit jacket, pressed it into my hand. You might want to hold on to this. I glanced down at it. It simply said, Brian Archer, with a phone number below the name. Nothing else. Thanks. Cool that I had the number of Pietro's security guy. Though I wasn't sure if he was giving this to me out of courtesy or because I had a tendency to get myself into trouble. Angel. I heard Marcus call from the direction of the tents. Quickly shoving the card into the front pocket of my pants, I glanced back to see him hurrying our way. He gave Brian the kind of nod you give to someone you know, then took me by the shoulders.
Are you all right?
I am now, but... She's fine, sir, Brian interjected. A little banged up for the moment. She slipped on some mud on the sidewalk after the extras left. I closed my mouth and stared at Brian. He was covering for me?
Well, I did say that I needed an alibi.
I hadn't been serious, but it certainly made things easier. Marcus exhaled, tension in his face easing. He gave a nod to Brian, then looked back at me.
You're sure you're okay?
I tore my eyes away from Brian. Yeah, it was no biggie, I said, more than a little thrown off by the totally unexpected ally. Brian took a step back, his eyes lingering on me. I'll be going now, and we'll let Mr. Ivanov know exactly what happened, he said with a faint stress on exactly. Have a good evening, sir, ma'am, he added with a nod in our direction. Thanks for all your help, Brian, I said with an equally faint stress on the all. He gave me a slight smile. Anytime, Miss Crawford. He turned and headed off toward the parking lot, pausing on the way to pick up and pocket the forgotten bag of brain chips.
What the hell were you thinking?
Marcus asked, dropping his hands from my shoulders.
Why didn't you call me?
I bristled. Yep, here it was. There wasn't time to call, I told him. And Jane called Pietro, right? Marcus blew out an exasperated breath.
Jesus Christ, Angel. You didn't know what you were doing, or who you were going after. Some drunk extra? I know you're strong, but someone else could have handled it.
He said it all in a patronizing tone that slid right under my skin.
And what if it had turned out to be something worse?
I'd planned to tell him about Philip, if not all the details about the broken wrist and such, but holy crap, I was so not in the mood to get chewed out. Annoyed, I edged back from him. Who else was going to handle it? Someone who didn't know it was a zombie and could have ended up a victim? I was the only one there who could do something. Marcus stared at me for a second.
Wait, it was a zombie?
I glared right back at him. Yeah, it was a zombie made up like one of the zombie extras. I don't know if he really was an extra or just pretending to be. A zombie pretending to be a zombie pretending to be a zombie made me dizzy.
So you didn't go after a drunk dude. You went after a crazy hungry zombie.
Yeah, and if I didn't do something, someone was going to get hurt, I said, and I was tanked. I scowled at him. Come on, Marcus, I handled it, didn't I?
Sure, this time, he said, eyes dark with worry. But it could have turned out differently.
So can walking out to get the damn mail, I shot back. Marcus, I handled it. Can't you give me a little bit of credit for that?
Okay.
He sighed, then gave me a smile.
You're right. Forget I said it.
Relief pushed back the annoyance. He was trying, and I had to give him props for that. And it was damn important. If we could ever get past this babying crap, we might actually have a chance to make it together. Okay, yeah. This time had actually been a teensy-weensy bit dangerous, but that wasn't the point. I gave him a smile in return, then wrinkled my nose. Anyway, I'm pretty soaked now, so I guess that's my sign that I've eaten enough. He slid an arm around me.
Ready to call it a day and head home? Pietro's going to get Jane out of here as soon as he knows you're okay, which I'm sure Brian has already told him by now.
Probably best. I gave him a squeeze. Thanks. I had a really great time. Even with zombie chasing.
And lots and lots to think about. Lots.
He chuckled.
I did too. Besides, I think I'd explode if I ate one more thing.
I laughed as we headed for the parking lot.
Body parts everywhere.
Ew,
that would ruin some dinners, he said, grinning.
No, I said. I'd tell everyone it was part of the movie promo.
As long as I died for a noble cause.
I gave a solemn nod. Overeating is the noblest of causes. Chapter 6 I'd actually planned ahead for once and swapped part of my 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. shift with Jerry, the other full-time van driver, so that I didn't have to come in so early in the morning after the late night out with Marcus. Jerry was an early riser who hated working nights, which meant he was more than happy to take the first half of my regular shift. And in return, I agreed to be on call for him until midnight. And so, of course, the call for the first body pickup of the day came at 2 minutes past noon, during a downpour like Niagara Falls. The van's windshield wipers slapped hard at the pouring rain, and I squinted to read street signs through the slight fog on the windows. A silver pickup crossed the intersection ahead, same make and model as the one that almost hit me on the movie set, the one Philip saved me from. I frowned. What the hell was that about? Save me, then be a total asshole like he'd been last night. It made no sense. A piece clicked into place. It made no sense until I remembered what he said when he cut my jacket. Have to make sure the goods aren't damaged. So he hadn't saved me from the truck. He'd saved me for someone else. But who? Dr. Cherish? Some new bad guy? Whatever. He'd earned a choice spot on my shit list. I finally found the street I needed and made my way down a street lined on both sides by identical duplexes. It could have easily been horrifying in an institutional and conform sort of way, yet I saw that the residents here found all sorts of ways to add character to the cookie-cutter structures and make their own place unique. Even through the driving rain, it was easy to note personal touches from carefully tended flower beds to small additions like gazebos or rock gardens to choice of paint colors. I had no doubt that everyone who lived along this street was a renter, and it impressed me that, with rare occasions, they all seemed to take pride in where they lived. I'd never lived in a rental a day in my life, and right now the biggest personal touch I gave my house was to keep the weeds hacked down to something that could resemble a lawn. Darrell's Dodge Durango and the St. Edward's Parish Sheriff's Office crime scene van were already parked by the curb in front of my destination. I only saw one unmarked unit, which told me that this was the type of death that didn't require a horde of detectives. I parked behind the unmarked car, then pulled on a raincoat I'd picked up at Goodwill during my gala shopping. On a normal-sized human, it would probably hit mid-calf, which meant it was ankle length on me. And when I paired it with the white rubber shrimp boots I currently sported, I had every confidence it would keep me awesomely dry. The only drawback was the polka dots. Lots and lots of polka dots in varying sizes and in eye-searing colors. Fine. I'd be dry and visible. Detective Abadi sat in the front seat of the unmarked car, typing on his laptop. I rapped hard on his window as I passed and gave him a big bright smile when he jerked in surprise. He raked a gaze over the raincoat, rolled his eyes, and gave me a sour look before returning his attention to his laptop in a pointed dismissal. I laughed and continued up to the house with the stretcher and body bag. Abadi didn't like me, though he'd once clarified that he didn't hate me, he simply didn't like me, which somehow made all the difference in the world, and made it particularly fun to harass him in any innocuous way I could. This duplex had a small but tidy front yard and a utilitarian no-frills look about it, a couple of pieces of white wicker outdoor furniture and nothing else on the porch. Darrell stood there out of the rain and looked up from his notepad as I approached.
Nice slicker, he remarked. 4 more days, right?
I got the stretcher and myself under shelter, pushed my hood back, and shook the worst of the water from my raincoat. Is everyone counting down to my GED test date?
I asked in mock exasperation.
Sure thing. There's a big calendar down at Double D's Diner.
At my shocked look, he laughed.
I'm kidding, promise. Figured that might be a bit too much pressure on you.
You think? I said, then gave a weak laugh. I'm barely holding it together as it is.
You'll do great.
He stated, with such utter conviction that it was hard not to believe it. Thanks, Darrell. I slipped my raincoat off and draped it over the back of a chair. So what you got here? I asked with a jerk of my head toward the house. His eyes dropped to his notes.
Brenda Barnes, white female, 28 years old, roommate, found her dead on the bathroom floor about an hour ago. No obvious trauma.
You think it might be drug overdose? Sadly, the death of someone that young was far too often the result of such a thing. I should know. Hell, it had been an OD that had got me turned into a zombie. But Darrell shrugged, shook his head.
Doubtful. No vomit or pulmonary edema. The roommate, Ginger Nielsen, swears the victim wasn't a user, and there were no pill bottles or other evidence of that.
I guess that's both good and bad, I said with a slight wince. I mean, good in that it wasn't a bullshit way to die.
Agreed. So, for now, I'm not inclined to call it a suicide or an OD, though toxicology will show that for sure.
He closed his pad.
The roommate says she turned the victim over when she found her, so we don't know what her original position was. But she stated that it looked like the victim simply fell to the floor.
I nodded. Perfectly natural reaction to move the person to see if they were okay, or to try and help them. It was only a big deal when it was a murder or anything suspicious, since moving the body could alter or wipe out evidence. Darrell pulled out his phone and stepped away, no doubt to call Dr. LeBlanc and give him the rundown. Pushing the stretcher before me, I headed inside. The decor within echoed the bare, no-nonsense feel of the exterior. Simple furniture. Couch, love seat, and coffee table, with scrapes and dings that spoke of their age. A modest-sized TV, a bookshelf made of cinder blocks and pine boards, with an assortment of worn paperbacks, knick-knacks, and framed pictures on it. Yet everything was clean and tidy, and I got the impression the no-frills look was due more to a careful hoarding of available funds than a lack of creative personality. In the living room, a young teary-eyed brunette in jeans and a t-shirt stood with her arms hugged around herself. The roommate, no doubt. Ginger. That's what Darrell said her name was. I heard the click of a camera shutter, and a peek down the hallway told me that the crime scene tech, Sean, was still working. The young woman looked over at me where I stood by the stretcher. "This is horrible," she said, voice quavering. "She was so happy." "I'm sorry for your loss," I said, hating how empty the words sounded. But I never knew what to say to the bereaved. I usually didn't have to say anything, since Darrell was the one to handle that stuff. He always knew what to say. For that reason alone, I wasn't sure I could ever be a death investigator. I'd fumble it and say something inappropriate, or worse, start crying along with the grieving friend or relative. But apparently, my empty phrase of condolence was all right. Ginger let out an unsteady sigh and shook her head. "She'd just gotten a break, and then this. It's like a cruel joke." "What kind of break?" I asked. Ginger dabbed at her eyes with the wadded-up tissue in her hand. "She'd been unemployed for nearly a year. One of the first to be laid off by the factory. Then she got the call to be an extra in high school zombie apocalypse." "2!" I said, then instantly regretted cracking a joke about the movie. But a small smile touched Ginger's mouth. "She used to laugh about that, too. Pretty silly, I know. Still, the laid-off workers were given first dibs. Sure, it's temp work and a goofy movie, but it paid well. And an extra grand or so makes a big difference when you're barely scraping by, you know? Brenda said it was like winning the lottery for a bunch of folks." I nodded, in understanding. Barely scraping by and I were old buddies. She sighed and crumpled the tissue in her hands. "And even beyond the money, she was having the time of her life. They'd even talked to her about doing a small part in another production."
I bet being in a movie totally rocked, I offered. She smiled a bit again. Whenever Brenda got home, she'd tell me all the cool little details. She reached for a stack of pictures on the coffee table, pulled three out, and handed them to me. Look, here she is with and without makeup. The first showed a petite redhead, grinning and waving in front of one of the movie set trailers. The second was a smiling zombie with a maggoty gash in the gray rotting flesh of her cheek. And the third, that same zombie with slack face reaching toward the camera with convincing movie zombiness. That's really cool, I said. Looks like she was having fun.
She was one of the featured zombies, Ginger said with a touch of pride in her voice.
I peered at the photo. Was she at the gourmet gala last night? Some of the extras were there for a promo thing. Ginger nodded.
She sure was. I talked to her when she got home. I guess at about 11 or so. She said it was a blast.
Her face fell again.
God, and now she's dead. This is so crazy. Was Brenda a real zombie like Tim and his friend last night? I wondered. But if so, surely she wouldn't look like a normal dead person now.
I itched to get close to the body to find out for sure, and to my relief, Sean stepped out and gave me the nod that told me it was okay for me to do my thing. Luckily, Darrell chose that moment to return inside, so I was safe from having to say something like, "It's been great talking to you, but now it's time for me to put your roomie in a body bag." But, you know, less insensitive. Darrell gently guided Ginger to the couch to get more information about Brenda's next of kin, and I made my escape to the easier company of the dead chick. There she was, on her back on the bathroom floor, looking as if she was asleep, except for the utter stillness and half-open eyes. She definitely wasn't a zombie either. No whiff of rot. And I was barely hungry enough to smell a regular, unzombified brain within her skull. I made quick work of getting her into the bag, and as she was slender and short, I didn't need Darrell's help to get her onto the stretcher. I draped the dark blue coroner's office cover over the body bag, then wheeled the stretcher out while Darrell kept Ginger occupied. Even though it was obvious a body bag lay beneath the sedate cloth, it still offered a bit of shielding from the emotional impact. Darrell and I were pretty good about doing our best to make sure friends and family didn't have to see the body being removed. That was one of those final things that tended to hit people pretty hard. By the time I got outside, the rain had slacked off to a sluggish drizzle, still annoying after so many days of rain, but better than the earlier deluge. I tugged my raincoat back on, then pushed the stretcher and its burden to where I'd parked. A flicker of movement down the street caught my eye as I shoved the stretcher into the back of the van. I closed the door and turned, mystified to see a blonde woman with a camera aimed in my direction. That's the same chick who was taking pictures of me on the movie set. What the hell? Though I knew damn well she saw me looking at her, she didn't lower the camera, and no doubt got some great photos of my scowl. A few seconds later, she turned and strolled casually off in the opposite direction. Shit! Every muscle in my body screamed at me to chase her down and demand to know why the hell she was taking pictures of me. But leaving a body in the van so that I could run down the street was a sure way to get fired. As if the universe wanted to help me make up my mind, lightning split the sky, followed immediately by a crash of thunder that shook the van. I jumped and let out a squeal, then dashed for the driver's side door and climbed in. Yeah, I could probably survive being struck by lightning, but it would hurt like a son of a bitch. About 2 seconds later, rain slammed down in a deafening roar on the roof of the van. Fine, I could take a hint. No chasing down mysterious photographers today. But as soon as this rain let up, all bets were off. Even with the wipers going at Mach 10, the visibility remained utter crap. To add to the driving fun, the ditches and drainage systems had obviously thrown up their collective hands and said, "Fuck it, I give up." Which meant that water of varying depths covered half the damn streets. And of course, that meant that traffic was a friggin' nightmare because apparently heavy rain and flooding streets were signals for everyone with a car to leave the house and run every non-essential errand they'd been putting off until the weather and road conditions were maximum shit. Yeah, I was in a peachy mood. The rain eased up to slightly less apocalyptic levels by the time I reached Tucker Point.
As I drove past the high school, I peered over to see if the movie people were trying to shoot in the rain. But while there were plenty of trucks and trailers parked by the main building, there was little sign of activity. Probably doing as many interior shots as possible, I decided. A few people clustered under the overhang at the front of the school. A red-haired man gestured at the downpour in obvious agitation as a slim black woman stood with folded arms and gave a disinterested nod as if she'd heard the rant before. Another man in a suit paced back and forth with a cell phone held to his ear, while a mousy woman in jeans and a t-shirt looked out at the rain with a faint smile on her face, as if enjoying the show nature had put on for her. I made it to the morgue without further incident, got the body of Mrs. Brenda Barnes inside and logged in. As soon as I finished that, two funeral home workers showed up, one right after the other, and I went through the usual rigmarole of releasing the bodies they'd come to pick up. Neither of the funeral home workers were zombies. I smelled quite edible brains in both of their skulls. In fact, I realized, after each departed with his respective cargo, that in the past 6 months, the few zombies I'd met had all been associated with Pietro's organization. I hadn't met any independent zombies in that time. I paused as I set out the scalpels and tools for Dr. LeBlanc and pondered that. It was true that Ed had succeeded in killing off close to half a dozen zombies, including Kang, who I'd met not long after I'd been zombified. He was the first zombie to give me the slightest clue about how to survive as a brain eater. His job at Scott Funeral Home supplied a sideline in dealing brains to a handful of undisclosed local zombies, at least until Dr. Cherish put a bounty on his head, literally, and Ed decapitated him. After I escaped her, Pietro's people supposedly recovered Kang's head, along with others from her lab, but I hadn't heard a thing about it since. And maybe there was more to Kang than I knew. Hell, I'd only been a zombie a short time before he was killed. So were the only zombies left in this area ones who worked for Pietro? Or were there still zombies who worked at the various local funeral homes, though not in any capacity where I'd come into contact with them?
Angel?
I jerked, startled out of my reverie by the voice behind me.
Shit!
I dropped the scalpel in my hand and turned to see Dr. LeBlanc.
Jesus, she scared the crap out of me,
I said with a shaking laugh. But instead of giving an answering laugh, his eyes dropped to my left hand, and a look of alarm spread across his face.
Good Lord, Angel.
I looked down to see a deep slice along the lower part of my thumb.
Crap,
I thought, as I stared stupidly at the gaping flesh of the inch-long gash and the thick drip of blood onto the floor. I just mopped that. Luckily, Dr. LeBlanc had no desire to gaze at the pretty patterns my blood made on the tile. With a quick motion, he seized one of the towels I'd set out and pressed it to my hand.
I'm sorry I startled you,
he said, concern in his eyes as he maintained pressure on the gash.
You were standing so still, I thought something might be wrong.
Sorry, I replied with a weak smile. I was lost in thought. He lifted my hand, pulled the towel away enough to allow him to peer at the wound.
Crap, I thought again. I wasn't tanked enough for it to have healed on its own at all.
Then again, that was probably good, since it would have been really tough to explain why I'd been bleeding only seconds earlier.
Oh, damn, he said, wincing. You're going to need a few stitches in that.
I groaned. Oh, no, is this a workman's comp thing? Will I have to fill out an incident report? I knew the answer to that. I'd damn well memorized the employee manual to be extra sure I wouldn't accidentally give Alan a reason to write me up or fire me. Any injury requiring medical attention required a metric fuckton of paperwork.
Sadly, yes, he said, pressing the towel back down over my hand. But since it was completely my fault, I'll write it up for you.
He gave me a smile.
Least I can do.
Can you stitch it up as well? I asked hopefully. There's no way I'm going to sit in an ER for something this tiny, especially when a few slugs of brain smoothie would take care of the whole problem.
Crap.
This meant I couldn't eat until this whole thing was dealt with. To my dismay, Dr. LeBlanc shook his head.
Best that I don't. However, I know someone who can do a fine job on it and save you an ER trip.
With that,
He led me back to the main building, though he allowed me to hold the towel on my hand myself. I expected him to lead me out and over to Dr. Duplessis's practice, which was right across the street. But instead, he shocked me by bringing me to Alan Prejean's office.
"Alan, we've had a bit of an accident," Dr. LeBlanc said, contrition tinging his voice. "Completely my fault."
Alan frowned, eyes going to the bloody towel around my hand.
"What happened?"
"Angel was setting out equipment, and I jostled her when she had a scalpel in her hand," he said, surprising me with the mild lie.
Maybe he figured Alan would still find a way to make it my fault if it came out I'd cut myself because Dr. LeBlanc had startled me.
Damn, but I love the pathologist.
Alan opened his bottom desk drawer, pulled gloves out of a box and tugged them on, then stood and moved to me. I let him examine the gash, and even I had to admit it was an ugly wound for a non-zombie to have. The cut extended from the outer edge of my thumb into the meat of my palm. It gaped open about a quarter of an inch, and I could see the white sheen of a tendon within. Didn't hurt, though. That was nice.
"Need stitches," Alan muttered. "Probably about 5, I'd say."
Dr. LeBlanc nodded.
"I agree. But any chance we can take care of that here and avoid her wasting hours in the ER?
Alan looked up at Dr. LeBlanc.
"I could do it since it missed the tendon. I mean, I have a suture kit, but I don't have any lidocaine."
"I don't need it numbed up for just a few stitches," I said quickly. Alan gave me a doubtful look, but I hurried on. "Seriously, if you can stitch it up, that'll be fine."
"I'll get started on the incident report while you take care of Angel," Dr. LeBlanc said, as if the matter had been decided.
After another couple of seconds of hesitation, Alan shrugged.
"Okay, but no screaming or crying," he grumbled. "Come on."
I followed him down the hall and into a small, rarely used room that had become more of a catch-all storage space than the consulting room it once was.
"Have a seat there by the desk,"
he told me as he looked through the cabinet. I did so, mentally bracing myself against him being a jerk to me, or rougher than necessary, or any crap like that. Hunger poked at me, reminding me how unnecessary all this was, and I bit back a sigh. Alan turned back to me with suture kit, wound wash, and towels in his hands, set them all on the desk, and flicked on the swing arm lamp. He folded one of the towels into a pad and set it on the desk by me.
"Okay, Angel. Rest your forearm there. Get comfortable."
"Thanks for doing this," I remembered to say as I set my arm on the folded towel. I really didn't want to have to go to the emergency room. He unrolled another towel and draped it over my forearm.
"Emergency room sucks," he said. "This way you'll be done in 15 minutes instead of 3 hours.
"You've done a lot of stitching?"
Not that it really mattered, since I wasn't exactly worried about him botching it up. Even if he did, a slug of brains would take care of it.
Alan didn't shift his careful focus from the wound.
"I've gone with Dr. Duplessis 4 times on Doctors Without Borders rotations," he said. "Did quite a few sutures."
I blinked at him in surprise. "Really? Like other countries?" The instant the words left my mouth, I realized how stupid they sounded. But Alan didn't deliver the condescending sneer I expected.
"Yes," he replied, as he opened the suture kit and began removing items. "Africa, Guatemala, and Haiti 2.
"I never knew that," I said, frowning slightly. "Why don't you ever talk about it?"
"It hasn't come up," he replied with a small shrug.
He picked my hand up carefully and sprayed wound wash on it. I wasn't sure if it was supposed to sting, but I figured I'd give a slight wince anyway. "Wow, did you like it?" I asked.
"I wouldn't have gone 4 times if I didn't," Alan replied.
He finished cleaning the slice, then replaced the towel beneath my arm with a fresh and dry one.
"I'm going again in October, but without Dr. Duplessis this time."
He pulled off the latex gloves he had on, then put on fresh sterile gloves from the suture kit. "That's really cool," I said, meaning it. "Where are you going?"
"Guatemala, again, to work in a children's services clinic in the highlands," he said.
He picked up the needle, then adjusted my hand on the folded towel.
Okay, Angel,
he said, speaking calmly and, to my continued surprise, gently.
Take a deep breath and let it out.
I did so, fascinated and a teensy bit weirded out by this completely alien-to-me side of him, then watched as he did the first stitch with smooth efficiency and tied it off. He'd obviously done this a few thousand times. Alan glanced up at me, a small frown touching the corners of his mouth.
Damn, Angel. You didn't even wince.
Shit. Oh, I was watching you do it and, kind of forgot it was supposed to hurt. I let out a weak laugh that sounded false even to me. He pursed his lips, then returned his attention to my hand and began the second stitch.
Watching usually makes it worse.
I guess working in the morgue has gotten me really used to gore, I shrugged. Seems less scary to watch and see what's going on. He knotted the thread.
Actually, I'm the same way. I'd rather see it coming than be surprised.
He turned my hand slightly.
I think you can get away with only 4 stitches on this, he stated. It's really shallow here at this end.
Okay, cool. Thanks, I said. I guess it's good the scalpel was really sharp. I mean, I barely even felt it. I winced as he did the next stitch, but when his frown deepened slightly, I suspected I'd done so a fraction of a second too late.
Do you generally have numbness in your hands?
He asked as he tied off the last stitch.
Or a lack of sensitivity to touch?
Double shit. Nope, not at all, I replied brightly. I lifted my right hand and wiggled my fingers. Totally fine. Alan cut the suture thread and set the needle aside.
Even a sharp scalpel hurts like hell, I know.
How the hell was I supposed to explain it in a believable way? That arm was broken when I was 12, I said. Maybe there was nerve damage or something. He shrugged, cleaned the wound area again, then taped gauze over the stitched cut.
Could be. You definitely don't have normal pain sensitivity.
Or just used to it, I said before I could stop myself.
Used to getting sliced?
He asked, frowning more. No, used to getting hurt. I hesitated, then gave him a tight and humorless smile. Mom used to smack me around. That's how my arm got broke. I explained, even as I wondered why the hell I was telling him this. She went to jail for it. And died there, I thought. Killed herself on my 16th birthday. Luckily, I had enough self-control to keep from sharing that lovely tidbit of family history. But he didn't comment on my little revelation. He wrapped up the suture kit, dropped the needle into a sharps disposal container, stripped the gloves, and placed them in a biohazard trash can.
You're all done,
he told me, curtly, sounding almost harsh after the gentler tone of before.
I'll check on it in a couple of days, but I don't anticipate any issues with it. Keep it clean.
Sure thing, I said. The old Alan was back. Thanks for saving me a trip to the ER.
Don't make a habit of it,
he replied, then left the room without a glance back. I sat silently for another couple of minutes. Why the hell had I told him about my mom and her abuse? Because for a short time he'd been almost nice to me? Great. He treated me like a normal person, so of course I had to make sure he knew I wasn't normal. Taking a deep breath, I stood and returned to the morgue. After pulling gloves on over the gauze, I finished getting everything ready for the autopsy. Dr. LeBlanc returned as I was getting the body of Brenda Barnes onto the table. I hid a smile as I noted he was deliberately noisy as he walked.
Everything go all right?
He asked. Went great, I said brightly. All put back together. He glanced down at my hand.
Does it bother you? We can postpone until the morning, or I can get someone else to assist if it hurts too much.
Oh, no, I'm cool, I assured him. Alan did it in 4 stitches, hardly aches at all. Dr. LeBlanc gave an approving nod.
He's good. I know you have your differences, but anything is better than the emergency room for such a minor wound.
I got the body stripped of clothing and shoved the block under her shoulder blades so that her back was arched, making it easier for Dr. LeBlanc to do the Y incision and examine her organs.
With her head dropped back, I could see remnants of the zombie makeup. Green, gray, and beige grease paint along her jawline, and square patches of lingering adhesive on her neck. I stepped back and looked over at the pathologist. Why doesn't he like me? It bothered me now. It had never bothered me before, at least not like this. But now Alan was someone I could actually respect, and suddenly his opinion of me mattered. And that bothered me as well. A grimace flickered across his face as he shook his head.
I don't know, Angel. It's been like that since day one.
Taking a deep breath, I did my best to throw off the stupid desire to give a shit about Alan's opinion of me. Oh, well, I said. Brenda's been waiting long enough. Let's get to cutting. Chapter 7. The autopsy of Brenda Barnes went quickly, though Dr. LeBlanc remained puzzled about the cause of death despite knowing what had killed her. Hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, which was a condition where the heart muscle got too thick to pump blood properly, he'd explained. What he couldn't figure out was how the heck she could have had that condition, since her medical records showed absolutely no sign of any thickening whatsoever in a full physical she had right before being laid off only a year earlier. Muttering about misread test results and sloppy record-keeping, he returned to the main building in the late afternoon, leaving me free to finally scarf down some brains to appease the insistent waves of hunger. I peeled up the gauze and tugged the sutures out of my healed flesh since they itched like crazy now, then taped the gauze back down. Later, I'd figure out how to keep Alan from wanting to check it in a few days. Oh, yeah, and figure out some way to explain why it healed without a scar. Maybe I could buy some miracle scar cream and claim it did the trick. I groaned and resisted the urge to beat my head against the cooler wall. After making absolutely sure I was alone in the morgue, I retrieved an empty container from my cooler and harvested the brain of Miss Barnes. During an autopsy, the organs, including the brain, were removed, examined, and samples taken to be stored in formalin. Yet afterward, the organs weren't returned to their former body cavity, but instead ended up in a big plastic bag that was set between the body's legs for its trip to the funeral home. Therefore, once the autopsy was complete, I snagged the brains out of the bags for my own consumption. In fact, that's how I'd met Kang. He'd confronted me after he noticed that the brains were missing from the body bags when they arrived at his funeral home. I got the container safely tucked away in my cooler and back in my car without incident. The rest of my shift was blissfully dull, with only one other body pickup, an apparently natural death of a man with a history of heart disease, who showed all the signs of a heart attack. Once he was in the cooler and logged into the system, Darrell and I grabbed a bite to eat at Paco's Tacos, then I returned to the morgue and managed to squeeze in several hours of studying. When midnight finally rolled around, I clocked out, left the van keys in the box by the door, and got the heck out of there. Lightning, followed by a tooth-rattling crash of thunder, heralded the start of another goddamn downpour. I dashed to my scrappy little Honda, yanked the door open, and clambered in. It sure as hell wasn't worth much on the open market, but it ran, most of the time, and right now it scored points for being dry. I jammed my keys into the ignition and cranked the car. Hunger, the normal human kind, reminded me that though I'd gorged on tacos at 7, it was now after midnight. What the hell? A late-night snack never hurt anyone. There wasn't a whole lot open at this hour, but the flickering neon of Double D's Diner promised de-stressifying pie and hot chocolate, plus the parking lot had only 3 other cars in it. Score. The rain still pelted down in torrential sheets. I clutched my dorky raincoat around me, pulled down my hood, and made a dash for the slim awning over the door, then scowled blackly as the rain abruptly eased to a mere drizzle. Really? I snarled up at the sky. You couldn't ease up 30 seconds earlier. I shook the worst of the water off and entered the diner, hung my raincoat on a peg beside 2 normal yellow ones and a bedraggled umbrella, then headed to the counter. The waitress slid a mug of hot chocolate and a plate full of apple pie to me as soon as I sat down. You know me too damn well, Arlene, I said with a laugh. The rangy, well-worn woman grinned.
I know how you are when you get off work in the middle of the night.
She leaned her elbows on the counter.
Anything good today?
She asked with a gleam in her eye. Sorry, I told her. Only one today, and there was no mess or yuck of any sort. Very ordinary, natural death. She heaved a disappointed sigh and pushed off the counter.
How am I supposed to live vicariously through you if you don't got any good stories?
I laughed. I'll make up something good and gory for the next time I come in here.
You better,
she announced, then sauntered away to check on another customer. Grinning, I dug into my pie and allowed the loving embrace of sugar and fat to shield me from my worries. I glanced around idly as I ate. The old bald guy at the far end of the counter was another regular, and a young couple nestled in a booth, laughing and whispering as they shared a heaping plate of blueberry pancakes. Through the broad windows of the diner, I saw a Jeep pull into the lot and park, angled with the passenger side toward me. But the headlights remained on, and no one made a move to get out for almost a full minute. Finally, the driver exited and moved to the back. Though she wore a light jacket with the hood up, I could tell it was a woman by the general build and grace of movement. She opened the hatch, huddling beneath it to stay out of the light drizzle as she rummaged through the contents as if looking for something. But my heart did a weird little flip when she straightened and pushed the hood back from her face. It was her, the stalker blonde. She didn't have a camera in her hands, however, and after a few seconds of frantic thought, I decided she probably hadn't followed me here. First off, I figured she'd be a little more sneaky about it if she had, plus the expression on her face was a far cry from the calm focus I saw earlier today. Even from this distance, it was tough to mistake the expression of worry and anxiety. She'd parked on the other side of the diner from my car, so there was a damn good chance she had no idea I was here. Perfect time to find out what the hell's going on. I dropped a tin on the counter to more than cover my coffee and pie, slung my purse across my chest, and headed out, grabbing my obnoxious raincoat on the way. Sure, without it I'd probably have an easier time getting close before she realized it was me, but I really didn't want to get wet. Yeah, I was a weenie. I strode toward the Jeep with my hood up and purpose in my step. With the way she was parked, I came up on the driver's side, which was fine with me. Hopefully that would make it easier to stop her if she tried to make a run for it. She was still doing something in the back, but the sound of crunching gravel beneath my boots alerted her to my approach. She ducked her head around the side of the Jeep, eyes widening in surprise at the sight of me. "Hey, you, I want to talk to you," I snarled. Alarm flashed across her features. Then in a smooth move, she stepped from behind the Jeep, pulled a shotgun from the back, and brought it up to hip level to point at me. I jerked to a stop, still about a dozen feet from her. Well, shit, I thought in surprise and a bit of annoyance. This escalated quickly. With the way her Jeep was angled, no one inside the diner could see the shotgun. They'd certainly hear the blast, though that wouldn't do me much good. "Just back off," the blonde woman said, tension roiling through her voice. Yet even though the barrel of the shotgun didn't waver, she really didn't look as if she wanted to shoot me. At all. On the other hand, she also looked scared and freaked and a little desperate, and I knew that sort of emotion soup could easily overcome any reluctance to pull the trigger. Her left hand steadied the barrel, and my eyes narrowed. She had a splint on that hand that I was pretty damn sure hadn't been there when I saw her earlier today. I shook my head slowly. "I'm not going to back off until you tell me what the hell's going on and why you're following me and taking pictures." "Because it's my job," she said, voice tight and full of desperate intensity. "But I'm not taking any more pics. I'm leaving." Her grip on the shotgun tightened. "So back off." I examined exactly where I was. "No, not backing off." I kept my own voice calm as I could manage. "What job do you have that includes stalking me?" She edged toward the driver's side door. "One I quit," she said. "And I have to get out of here." Watching her carefully, I took a slow step forward. "I'm not afraid of getting shot," I told her, which wasn't entirely true. Getting shot hurt, and I had a feeling getting shot by a shotgun would hurt a lot. But I knew damn well something more was going on. "You haven't answered my question."
"Please, I don't want to shoot you," she said, desperation thickening her voice now. "I have to go."
Her eyes flicked toward the highway and back to me. Was someone after her?
Look, are you into something fucked up? I asked, easing forward another step. Probably a stupid question, now that I thought about it, since she was holding a shotgun on me.
Maybe I can help, I added.
Hell, I knew that I'm so screwed look on her face. I'd seen it on my own a time or two.
A brief spark of hope flickered in her eyes, but then she shook her head and it died.
Yeah, really a twisted mess, she said.
To my relief, she lowered the shotgun.
I won't shoot you, but please, I have to go.
Her voice quavered.
The people I worked for, they'll be coming after me, and you don't want to be around when that happens.
Was she concerned for me? Or for what I might see or find out?
First, tell me who you work for, I said. Worked for, she replied, emphasizing the past tense.
She edged closer to the driver's door. I knew damn well she was about to make a break for it, and I tensed in expectation.
Yeah, fine. Who did you work for?
I shot back, allowing my annoyance to color my tone. As expected, she made an absolutely desperate attempt to yank the door open and get into the Jeep. I poured on the speed and closed the distance between us, grabbed the door handle as she slid into the seat, and blocked the door with my own body.
For fuck's sake, I snapped. Would you chill? I want some answers, and I'm not letting you go until you give them.
She breathed raggedly, seeming on the verge of tears, and, with the fierce strength that burned behind her hazel eyes, it looked utterly unnatural on her. She tugged futilely on the door a few times as if it would somehow convince me to move, then gave up and let her hand drop.
Shit, shit.
I swept a quick glance around. No one inside the diner seemed to notice our little altercation, helped no doubt by the fact that it was all happening on the side away from the broad windows, and the highway remained deserted.
Can we please talk?
I asked, returning my attention to her. She sagged.
Sure. Why the hell not?
Cool. Okay, cool. I glanced around again, then hurried around the front of the Jeep to the passenger side. I fully expected her to start the vehicle and try to take off during those few seconds, but for whatever reason, she seemed fairly resigned to my obnoxious desire for information. I slid into the passenger seat, shut the door, then gently pushed aside the barrel of the shotgun that lay across her lap so that it wasn't pointed straight at me.
All righty, that's better, I said.
My gaze dropped to her hand. The pinky and ring finger were heavily splinted, and purplish bruising showed between strips of tape.
Who broke your hand?
Exhaling, she leaned her head back against the seat. A curious expression of regret and admiration briefly passed over her face.
Brian Archer, Pietro Ivanov's head of security. He caught me trying to get pictures of Ivanov and Jane Pennington. Oh, wow, I said, more than a little shocked. Though once I thought about it, I had zero doubt that the ice-calm security guy could break fingers without biting an eyelash.
Her mouth pursed slightly in annoyance, and I got the sense it was at herself. For getting caught? Somehow I could totally believe that would irk this woman. Irked looked a lot more natural on her than the verge of tears thing. Whatever was going on had to be huge if it pushed her to that point.
And your bosses are mad you got caught? I asked, trying to put the pieces together. Yet I figured they'd have to be really mad for her to be this freaked. Surely there was more to it.
She gave a low snort.
They don't even know about that. It's other stuff I recently discovered about them.
Sighing, she shook her head.
I can't go back.
Her eyes went to mine.
Please, I really need to go, and you need to be far away from me.
I stubbornly didn't get out of the Jeep.
What's your name?
A flicker of exasperation lit her eyes.
Heather, she said, pointedly not giving a last name. I didn't bother asking for it.
I'm Angel Crawford, but I guess you know that already.
Yeah, I do.
Her gaze dropped from mine.
Tell me who you work for.
I didn't make it a question or request. She grimaced.
Saberton Corporation.
I didn't expect that answer.
I don't understand.
Why the hell would Saberton want pictures of me? But then my thick-headed brain decided to wake up.
Wait. They do defense contract stuff, don't they?
A chill swept through me. Did this have anything to do with Christy Cherish's Zolgers project? It had to.
Do you know why they wanted pics of me?
Heather shook her head.
Not just you. Pietro Ivanov and pretty much anyone associated with him.
What do you know about Pietro?
And me? I asked warily.
She took a deep breath as if clinging to calm by her fingernails.
I know what you are, she said, voice cracking slightly. And I'm leaving because I don't agree with Saberton's philosophy, especially when it comes to using your kind.
Her eyes flicked toward me. Zombies.
Yikes. I knew Dr. Cherish had been dealing with some government and corporate group when she had me as a test subject. Was that Saberton? Were they interested in her zombie soldier idea?
You know a lot of zombies?
I asked, still watching her. Met my first couple of years ago, John Kang, she said to my surprise. Kang, the first zombie who I knew was a zombie. He was my best friend, hands down, she continued, surprising me even more, especially with the depth of sincerity in her voice. Her mouth tightened. Saberton wanted him in their pocket because of all his contacts and connections. They wanted me to set him up to, encourage his cooperation.
Connections like Dr. Sophia Baldwin? I asked, cocking my eyebrow in her direction. Before her death, Dr. Baldwin had been working to develop fake brains that zombies could survive on instead of human brains. Heather gave a little nod, confirming my suspicion. This was getting more and more interesting. If interesting meant, holy shit, this is seriously messed up.
I knew Sophia, I said. She did a lot of zombie research.
I paused.
They're both dead, you know. Kang and Sophia.
Murdered.
Heather's good hand tightened on the barrel of the shotgun.
I know, she said, grief slashing across her face.
God, the only possible good thing that came out of Kang's death was that it happened before Saberton had the chance to get their hooks into him, or find out anything he knew. I struggled to put it all together. From what I'd seen, Kang hadn't held a Pietro level of power, but he certainly had influence among local zombies, especially those who weren't associated with Pietro. Ed had killed Kang, but I wasn't sure if Cherish had specifically ordered that hit, or if he'd taken it upon himself. However, she'd openly admitted to killing Sophia. If Cherish had been working with Saberton at the time, surely they'd been pissed at her about both losses.
Were you working with Christy Cherish? I asked.
Heather twitched, almost as if she was recoiling at the name. She obviously knew who Christy Cherish was.
Not directly, she answered.
I frowned. What about Philip?
Crap, I didn't even know his last name.
But again, she apparently knew who I was talking about. The corners of her mouth turned down, and her brows drew together.
Yeah. Known him about a year.
Gung-ho company man.
That meant he'd been working for Saberton for at least 6 months before Cherish forced me to turn him into a zombie. That made it pretty evident that Saberton had already been involved with Cherish at the time she'd kidnapped me.
He's a zombie now. An experiment gone bad. She continued with a shake of her head. Haven't dealt with him much since.
Her gaze rested on me as though waiting for me to say something.
Well, I didn't know how much she already knew, but I wasn't about to confirm that I was the one who made Philip a zombie.
Why are you freaked out about leaving? I asked instead. Or is this one of those deals where you don't simply walk away?
Her mouth twisted. It's one of those things where you know too much, don't like what you know they'll kill you over it, so you run and hide and figure they'll find you sooner or later.
She shook her head.
And they're on to me. So it's going to be sooner if I don't get out of here.
Silent, I considered her plight. I didn't know a damn thing about this woman except that supposedly she wanted to quit this evil company for somewhat vague reasons. But she knew Kang, and she definitely seemed upset about his death.
What if someone could help you?
I found myself asking. Heather raised an eyebrow, mouth pursed in skepticism.
You mean like if my fairy godmother came in and waved a wand? It's not going to happen.
How about a trashy guardian angel? I said, offering her a slight smile. She gave me a sigh.
Thanks, but I don't know what you could do.
I forced myself to logically consider why I felt an urge to help her out. It didn't totally make sense. After all, she was working for a company that was probably involved in Cherish's Zolgers, a project which was fucked up on numerous levels. But so far, all Heather had done to me was take pictures, as far as I knew, and she didn't want to work for Saberton anymore. Plus, the reason she wanted to leave was a damn good one in my eyes. I was cool with helping anyone who was against using zombies. But mostly it was that expression of, I'm so screwed, that got to me.
Look, I know what it's like to be in a no-win situation, and Pietro owes me a couple of favors, I said.
It would take a lot more than a ticket to the gourmet gala to make up for the fact that Pietro allowed Cherish to have me kidnapped.
Maybe he could help protect you, I shrugged.
Hell, maybe you could go to work for him instead.
Because I totally had that influence, right? I held back the urge to roll my eyes at myself. But hey, maybe she could be an asset to the zombie side of things.
Naked hope and a curious longing brightened her eyes for a brief instant before they shadowed again.
God.
Her brow furrowed, and she looked almost wistful.
I don't know. Do you really think he'd help?
It's worth a shot, right? I dug into my purse and pulled out Brian's card.
There you go, I said, setting it on the console. That's Brian's number.
She seemed cool, but I wasn't about to give her Pietro's. Jesus Christ, but I hope this didn't blow up in my face.
What the hell would I do if Heather called Brian and he told her to fuck off?
I didn't know if I could simply walk away from this now if that happened. Yet I also knew I'd put her in a really bad position. I'd slowed down her flight, and now I was trying to convince her to turn herself over to the enemy.
Her eyes dropped to the card, and I could practically see her memorizing the number.
You mean now, she said, glancing back up at me. It's after midnight.
Yeah, well, I'm pretty sure he's a robot and doesn't sleep, I said, then shrugged. Trust me. Those fuckers owe me enough that I can wake a few people up.
I paused.
Unless you want to wait till morning and see what happens.
Shit, no.
She pulled a phone out of her pocket. Yeah. I reached and put a hand on hers. And maybe better to use mine, in case yours is, tapped or whatever. She blew out her breath.
You're right. I'm not thinking all that clearly right now. I'm usually good in a tight situation, but this has me clamped down.
Pretty understandable. I retrieved my phone from the depths of my purse, dialed. I'm putting it on speakerphone, but I'll talk to him first. The tinny sound of the ringer filled the car, and a few seconds later,
Archer here.
A hint of hoarse slur in his voice suggested he'd likely been asleep.
Hey, Brian, it's Angel, I said. Hate to bother you so late, but remember that chick whose fingers you broke today? Well, she's here with me, and she wants to, defect.
The photographer?
He asked. Voice still a bit muzzy.
I don't understand.
Yeah, she works for Saberton and...
What?
He demanded, all hint of sleep gone. Blinking, I quickly put pieces together.
Oh, you just thought she was a reporter or something, didn't you?
I flicked a glance at her. She gave me a shrug in return, coupled with a pained grimace. I supposed I couldn't blame her for lying to Brian. If she'd admitted to being some sort of industrial espionage person, she probably wouldn't have escaped at all, and certainly not with only a couple of broken fingers.
Something like that, yes,
Brian replied, voice controlled once again.
Okay, well, she wants to leave, quit, but figures it's only a matter of time before they find her and, well, you know.
I could practically hear Brian processing all of this.
All right, Angel, he said with zero hint of the stress he was surely feeling. What does she want?
I handed the phone to Heather, though I kept it on speakerphone.
You're up, chick.
She bit her lip and took a deep breath.
Hello, Brian. It's me again. What do you want, Naomi?
Brian asked, or whatever your name is.
Naomi, huh?
I realized that Heather probably wasn't her name either, though truth be told, she looked more like